Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. Some roses are finicky, others are easy, some are subtle, some are showy, but regardless, our love affair with roses endures. ISU entomologist Donald Lewis is going to join us in just a few minutes, but we're going to start the hour with roses and Aaron Style, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens in Ames. Good morning, Aaron.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Yeah, it's great to talk with everybody.
And it seems like there are an endless variety of roses. So let's talk about some of the best ones for Iowa.
Well, for most of us here in Iowa, the ones that are kind of grouped as landscape or shrub roses are the best bet. They tend to be, they almost always are winter hardy. Many of the hybrid teas and floribundas and grandifloras are not winter hardy for us. And so if we want them to survive the winter, it takes a whole series of events in the fall and the spring to get them to overwinter. Whereas these shrub roses, they just live with everything else and you don't have to worry about that. And so that makes their care a lot easier. The other great thing about shrub roses is they tend to be more disease resistant than the more kind of classic hybrid tea, grandiflora, floribunda type roses. They have been bred to resist the common diseases like black spot, which can defoliate roses and leave you just with ugly thorny shrubs by the end of summer. So those two characteristics make them much lower maintenance and therefore a much more welcomed addition in the garden.
Although I think some people like the maintenance and like the challenge.
Yeah, you know, there is some of them. You know, it's so interesting to me because roses have been kind of labeled as these really finicky plants. And anybody who's had to deal with multiflora rose knows that they are not.
You can't kill them.
They are not finicky plants as a universal rule. And so some of the early roses, some of the more old-fashioned roses, are very hardy and easy to grow plants. But these kind of hybrids that have been developed, especially in the mid-1900s, are so much more difficult because they are not very disease-resistant and because for us they are not winter hardy. And so, yeah, you can really invest a lot of time, which can be fun to invest all that time in them. But for the average homeowner, that's a little more time than they usually want to spend on one plant.
Absolutely. So with the shrub roses that you're talking about, let's talk about sort of best practices. This year, watering is not something that we've really had to think about at all.
It hasn't been for the most part, although, you know, there's still a lot of potential for the season to kind of change a little bit. And if we get into a dry spell, roses will definitely appreciate being irrigated. Ideally, they would get about an inch of water a week in well-drained soil. So if Mother Nature doesn't provide that, then you would want to provide that. And when the gardener provides that irrigation, it's really important for roses to make sure that you try to avoid wetting the foliage as much as possible. Those disease issues like black spot and powdery mildew are compounded when the foliage gets wet. So if we can avoid that by using soaker hoses or watering at the base, or just watering in the morning so that the leaves can dry off more quickly, we can save a lot of time, hopefully down the road, dealing with some of those diseases.
All right, and we'll talk about those diseases in a few minutes because certainly the foliage has been plenty wet this year again.
Yes.
But let's talk about fertilization. I mean, what kinds of things, if we want to get the most blooms out of our roses, what kinds of things do we need to think about?
Well, adding a little bit of fertilizer for roses can be really beneficial to get good flowering. And we just went through that first series of that first flush of bloom for most roses. And that would be a good time to fertilize. So we often recommend that you fertilize first thing in the spring as things are breaking out. During the first bloom, which would have been probably the last couple of weeks. And then sometime in the middle, early to mid-July is the kind of final time to fertilize. And we don't want to fertilize much later than the end of July because we don't want to push a lot of growth on these plants later in the season where they may not be able to support that as things get cooler in the fall. So you still have time to put on another application of fertilizer here in July. You would use like a a nice, well-balanced fertilizer, like a 10-10-10 or a 5-10-5, something like that, to help. There are some fertilizers out there that are labeled for roses, and you could use those, but a general all-purpose fertilizer works well, too.
All right. And once you get those blooms, how about maintenance?
Yeah. So I mentioned that we just went through our first big flush of bloom for most of the roses across the state. And deadheading or removing the spent blossoms is going to be a really great way to help promote a rebloom. Some of the really old-fashioned roses won't probably rebloom or will rebloom very poorly, but a lot of the more modern cultivars, especially those knockout roses and easy elegance roses and cordis roses, buck roses, those are all much better at reblooming throughout the season. So you'll see a big flush of bloom in the early part, mid part of June, depending on the year, and then you'll see sporadic bloom throughout the year. And when you deadhead, you really encourage better bloom throughout the rest of the growing season. So you want to remove that spent flower when that flower is done or when the cluster is done. And we usually recommend that you cut down to the first leaflet of or leaf with five leaflets on the stem. So the leaves are compound, and higher up on the stem, they tend to only have three parts or three leaflets. You go down just a little bit lower, and they'll have five. And on some of them, they'll get even more. You want to cut back to that first leaf of five.
Now, a lot of us really like to to cut our roses to bring them inside, mm-hmm. of course, to enjoy the blooms a little closer to our living situation. When you cut roses, are there any things that you need to think about so that you're not damaging the plant or sacrificing more blossoms?
It's always good to try to make a cut right above, about a quarter of an inch above a leaf or a bud. And ideally, it's a leaf or a bud that's pointed outwards so that when a new branch forms, it doesn't grow into the plant, it grows out of the plant. And when you do bring them in, it's always best to harvest and cut flowers early in the morning. And it's always, you know, it's romantic to think about going out with a basket and cutting flowers and laying them in a basket. But ideally, you're going out there with a bucket of water and you're cutting them and immediately putting them in water.
You could take a pretty bucket if you wanted to, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you could do that. But getting them in water and getting them in a cool spot as quickly as possible will allow you to enjoy the flowers as long as possible.
All right. Now, let's talk about the encroaching plants around them. I mean, this is a terrible year for weeds. I'm sure
we'll
talk.
It's been so wet.
We'll talk much more about weeds as the hour goes on. This is my prognostication. But so to keep the area clear around your rose bushes, what's the best plan?
Well, keeping weed-free areas is good. It helps improve air circulation. It removes competition. The air circulation, of course, is good to help with disease issues. But hand pulling and removing weeds when you see them, you can lightly cultivate too. That's a good strategy. And then putting down mulch. Mulch has so many benefits, one of which is suppressing weeds. It also, over time, builds good soils. It helps conserve moisture. It helps regulate soil temperatures. It's just all around a good thing. So adding that mulch layer, and now is a good time to do that. If you go in there and you pull out all those weeds, if you have any, and then put down an inch or two of mulch, this is a great time of year to do that kind of work.
All right. And are there concerns about too much mulch?
Yeah, you don't want to put you'll want to put about an inch or two at this point, certainly not more than 3 or 4 inches. And you want to taper it up to the base of the plant. You don't want to bury the base of the plant. So, you know, right up next to where the plant goes into the ground, you may have it more like a half an inch. And then as you kind of feather it out, it gets a little bit deeper as it gets a little bit further away, but never deeper than, say, three or so inches is necessary. And the type of mulch you use is really up to the gardener. I really like shredded bark. I think it holds in nicely. But coco hulls look really wonderful in rose gardens, as does leaf mold. And so those are good options, too.
All right. Now, we talked about encouraging growth on your roses, but some of these shrubs can get big and a little bit out of control.
Yeah.
Do you have advice for how to shape a rose bush?
Well, especially some of the really old-fashioned varieties are runners. They produce rhizomes and stolons, and they sucker up everywhere. And if they're suckering in areas you don't want them, you're going to have to constantly kind of tackle them and cut them back. Either
which can
at ground
be painful.
Level. It can be. Yeah, I get a good, nice glove. And they sell, they're called Rosarian gloves, and they're thick leather gloves that go halfway up your forearm to help with the thorns and all of that. So if you have enough of them, they may be worth the investment.
All right. Now let's talk about disease. You already mentioned wanting to keep the foliage dry. And again, this year it's just been wet, wet, wet. So what kind of problems are we seeing on roses?
Well, it's very likely, especially on older cultivars, and especially on some of those varieties that are hybrid teas, grandifloras, floribundas, those types of roses, we will be seeing black spot if you haven't already. So this is a disease that you get a small black spot. It usually has yellow around it. Those black spots to get bigger. They start connecting together, and eventually the leaf will fall off, and you're left with this really ugly, thorny shrub, sometimes with pretty flowers on top of it. But it can be, especially later in the season, it can really take away from the appearance. So good garden sanitation is a good step for this. Good air circulation, making sure they're in full sun, avoiding wetting the leaves, all of those things will help. The best way to avoid this problem is good selection of roses. So buying roses that you know are more resistant to these diseases, in particular black spot. Powdery mildew is another one, probably number two on the list in terms of problematic for gardeners. So finding and searching and planting those roses that are more resistant to that is the best way. If you have a rose that gets this, or you want a rose that gets this for a different reason, then apart from some of those cultural practices I just mentioned, applying fungicide is your next option. And it is a laborious process. Every 7 to 14 days, you'll have to reapply if it rains more than a quarter of an inch, or you irrigate heavily and the leaves get wet. There are lots of fungicides out there labeled for roses. So there's a lot of options there, but it is very labor intensive.
And on a year like this, do you fight that fight?
You can. I tend to try, my approach is always, because I just don't like spraying. I don't like spending the money on spraying. I don't like the act of it. I don't like getting all dressed up to do it and mixing all the chemical. All that stuff is just not my cup of tea. So I really prefer to have good selection of roses, to do those cultural practices that I mentioned earlier, using mulch, good cleanup, avoiding overhead watering, so that I don't have to do that stuff. I don't want to do
it. You don't want to. All right. Yeah. It's a hort day. We're going to be back in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today with me, Erin Stile, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens in Ames. Also with us now, Iowa State University entomologist Donald Lewis. Hello, Donald.
Hello, Charity. Good to be here.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And of course, we've been talking about roses, and we saved pests for you, Donald.
Oh, you're just too kind.
All right. We'll get your microphone on here, hopefully, in a second. Jonathan will get that on for us. But all right. What are some of the insects that are hassling roses on a regular basis?
Well, and I can hear myself.
Yay.
Now. Yay, I'm here. Good to see you. Number one, most people are going to think of roses. They're going to think of Japanese beetles. And in my line of work, I think of roses as Japanese beetle food. That's why you would have roses, so you could raise Japanese beetles.
Right, I've got so many plants that are really, really helping those beetles out.
Yeah, but we haven't had very many yet this year. We have seen a few, but we have not had the emergence of tens of thousands of Japanese beetles like we sometimes get by the end of June. So they're a little behind schedule, and we'll wait to see how many come. But when we talk about Japanese beetles and the 350 different plant species they will feed on, roses are usually number one, two, or three. Grapes and linden trees are the others that vie for that top position. So roses are a favorite, and they will feed on the foliage and cause the skeletonization. They will feed on the buds and burrow right into the side and ruin your flowers that way. So they are the major bane of rose grower existence.
And what do we do about it?
Well, like Aaron does with his black spot, you could live with it. One of the things that happens is you could not try to have blooms during the peak of Japanese beetle season. So we're through the first bloom, But as the second bloom is coming on, you could just say, I'm going to tolerate the beetles, or I'm going to deflower the plants. I'm going to take off the buds to make sure the beetles aren't as attracted. It's sort of manage it that way. You can also put up screens. You could try to cover the roses during the peak of Japanese beetle time. Or you can try the insecticides. And for those who are willing to mix up sprays, there are lots of ingredients that you can spray on the roses that you have to repeat frequently to kill the beetles as they continue to emerge. And with roses, we also have the availability of systemic insecticides that you put on the ground, probably mixed in with that fertilizer that you put on already. And that systemic will help kill beetles after they have eaten your rosebuds. So there is a trade-off there. Yes, you're killing the beetles, but it may not kill them soon enough to suit you.
Okay. What are some of the other insects that might damage roses?
Well, aphids are sometimes on roses, but that's not such a big deal. We can wash those off with a stream from the garden hose. Sometimes we need an insecticidal soap. But if you have aphids, they could be deforming the growth. They could be sucking the sap and weakening them. We also get leafhoppers on roses that create these little white specks on the leaves, and that's a little disfiguring, but probably not too significant from the plant. The other one, though, if you don't have good air movement, if you have some other issues going on with the roses, you can get wiped out by spider mites. Spider mites aren't insects, but they're closely related, and they feed on the undersides of the leaves. They puncture the plant tissue and suck out the sap, and they keep moving from cell to puncture it, and you get these stippled areas, and you get this webbing all over the plant. And that usually happens in protected, dry locations. So we don't expect as many spider mites this year, but that's kind of the top of the list of what to watch for and make sure you're ready to combat them when they appear if you need to.
And you're getting my hopes up really high about Japanese beetles, because I remember after the last time we had a polar vortex winter, we had a pretty low Japanese beetle population that next summer.
Yes, but the winter of 2013-2014 had another combination of characteristics that we did not have this past winter. The fall of 2013 was very dry, and so we went into the winter with dry soils and grubs in the soil trying to exist in an area that was too dry for them. Then the freeze in the soil, the frost line in the soil, was very deep and very prolonged that year. So we had dry soils, prolonged freeze. This winter, we went in with wet soils. We had snow cover throughout the winter, which kept the soil from freezing very deeply. So we have a different set of circumstances. So I don't know what to predict. It just feels like the combination of characteristics wasn't right for a low Japanese beetle year. But here we are at the end of June, and we're not seeing very many of them yet. So maybe we're going to be lucky.
All right. Well, and of course, a lot of things have been behind schedule this year. Could that be a factor?
Sure. It could just be that they're late, that the soils stayed cool longer. The soils were moist, which may have held down the soil temperatures. And of course, the beetle development under the ground is dependent on the temperature. So maybe they're just behind schedule and they're going to show up after all. But so far, I can really count on both hands the number of Japanese beetles I have seen.
Huh. All right. Well, we'll just enjoy this while it lasts.
You bet.
Live in the moment. All right. You are welcome to join the conversation with your questions about plants or insects. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. Here's a question from Kevin. He says, I'm still buying and transplanting roses. I always use root stimulator when planting, but how long after transplanting can one use 10-10-10 or bloom fertilizer?
You'll want to stop fertilizing by the end of July for sure. And I would probably say, especially on a new plant, and especially if you're using, you know, root stimulizer and stuff, you could probably end a little bit sooner. We don't want to push too much growth in the hot, stressful time of the year going into the cool fall. So you may have one more application of fertilizer here before you would be done for the season.
All right. And we just kind of covered this, but I'm going to read the rest of his email as well. He says, also, we use the 3-in-1 systemic care fertilizer, but it never seems to have much effect on Japanese beetles. Is that just a waste of money, or is there a chemical out there to deter the beetles?
The systemics inside roses probably are working better than we realize, in that they may be killing beetles, but not until after they have eaten. The insecticide is inside the plant in that case, so the beetle has to eat the plant in order to be affected by it. But then more beetles keep coming. So I'm not a big fan of systemic insecticides generally in the landscape, but this is one where you probably are getting great effect in protection against aphids and leafhoppers. So I wouldn't call it a complete waste of time, but it's not as good against Japanese beetle as we would hope.
And you're not a fan because why?
Because I'm cheap.
Okay.
You know, it's just too much work. It's too much money. I've got better things to do with my time. Systemics have great use, and we have used them for a long period of time. But of course, they're also in the news because of the effects they may have on pollinators. Now, bees and flies and other insects don't visit hybrid tea roses, but some of our other kinds of roses, we may see those pollinators on there. And if we've put the systemic into blooming plants, there is a chance we could be affecting the pollinators. And one way to avoid that is just avoid using the systemic insecticides and fight the beetles where they are, when they are, rather than try to predict where they're going to be.
All right, take the battle to them. You can join us with your questions, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We'll get to the phones in just a moment, but here's another email about roses. This one's from Katie in Ames. I have a rose in my garden that I believe to be at least 30 years old. It came with the house. It has always done well, but this year appears to have developed chlorosis on half of the rose. I've tried a generic fertilizer, but it doesn't seem to have helped. It can't be overwatering, as the area it's on is very well drained and I never water it. Also, is there a way to find out what kind of rose it is?
Well, finding out which rose it is might be a little difficult, especially the older variety. You can certainly find out, maybe narrow it down to something it's likely to be. But there are so many cultivars and varieties of roses out there. You know, if it's a pink rose with lots of petals, the options that it could be are pretty broad. And so it might be hard to identify the cultivar. In terms of the chlorosis, I would look at the soil conditions for sure to make sure that things indeed aren't too wet or something like that. The other thing that I would maybe, especially if it's a rose that's important to me, I would probably look at sending in some kind of sample for this one, because chlorosis can be, you know, a lack of fertilizer or, you know, poor soil conditions. But there are also some, in particular, some viral issues that can pop up on roses that sometimes look like this. And so if it is a virus, it's something that you'll want to remove from your garden as soon as possible. But it's really hard to identify it as a virus without a little help. And so sending in a sample might be beneficial.
All right. Let's do one more email. We'll get to the phones next at 866-780-9100. This one is from Scott. He says, our neighbor has a giant sycamore tree. It is usually a beautiful tree with giant leaves. My best guess is that the tree is 50 to 70 years old. Could be older, I suppose. This year, the leaves are very scarce and have seemed to just started to come out in the past few weeks. The tree's actually on city property. Do we need to call the city? What are we doing?
No, you need drier weather, especially yes. In the springtime. Sycamore anthracnose is a fungal disease, and it has just been rampant on sycamores throughout the state this spring. And as every new leaf tries to grow on the ends of the twigs, the fungus attacks them and stops them where they are. And so it looks like we have no leaves at all. But suddenly, like in the third week of June, there was enough dry weather in the tops of the trees that leaves made it past that initial attack. And so now we have these tufts of leaves out on the ends. The plant pathologists always remind us that this isn't something we treat. This isn't something we worry about, because by the middle of July, you won't be able to tell there was a problem, but they always assume that it dries off in July.
Right. All right. We'll see. Let's go to the phones. Luann is on the line in Cedar Rapids right now. And again, you can join us at 866-780-9100. Hello, Luann.
Hi. Yeah, we have a maple tree, a mature maple, and it's got like spots of areas where it's, you know, dying. The leaves have just, you know, started turning brown, and not all of the tree is affected, but just you know, it's mainly on the south, but then there's spots in the, you know, middle of the tree too. So we were just, I was just wondering if there's something going on with maples.
Yeah, you know, there are some diseases that we've been hearing about across the state, especially with maple because of the wet start we had to the spring. And so what you described could be something along those lines. It would be good to have a trained professional to get their eyes on it in particular. And so looking at an arborist to come out and take a peek at this tree would probably be a good idea, especially if it's something that's important in your landscape to you. So it's hard to say just based on that general description specifically what could be causing that issue. It sounds a little bit like a disease issue. And on a mature tree, one bad year may not cause an issue, but depending on what it is, if you lose some major branches or if it's something that is more systemic within the tree, it could be something that would require treatment. So getting a professional out to take a peek at it will be a good next step.
All right. Luann, thanks a lot for your call. We have another maple question. So this one's from Muscatine. We have a beautiful sugar maple, but this year on the north side of the tree, there are lots of dead branches, very few leaves, and the leaves are dry and burnt looking. The south side of the tree looks perfectly healthy.
Yeah, we've been hearing a lot, and I've been seeing some of this too. And I think it's a combination of some of the weather conditions we had this winter going into the spring being particularly cold, but this spring being particularly wet. And so keep an eye on those branches and make sure, you know, they may, if it was a, you know, like an anthracnose or something like that, you may see buds break out again later in the season. As long as, you know, the branches are still pliable and they're green under the bark if you scratch them, we can chalk it up to something related to weather, but keeping a good eye on it, making sure it's not spreading through the tree. And then much like the last caller or question, you know, bringing in a professional to take a peek at it, get their eyes on it, and maybe even conduct a couple of tests to make sure that it's not some kind of fungal issue would be good.
All right. Here, we'll go back to the phones. Jim is on the line from Des Moines. Hi, Jim.
Morning.
Hi, what's your question?
Got a kohlrabi question in my vegetable garden. The plant's a 16-foot row of kohlrabi that just looks great with no kohlrabis at the base of them at all. Is there something going on?
I don't know. I would expect to see those little bulbous things forming certainly by now. And kohlrabi tends to like cooler temperatures, and so I wouldn't necessarily say that the weather has been a challenge for them this year. It could be something as simple as mislabeled plants. Kohlrabi, broccoli, cauliflower, cabbage, even some kales all look very similar, especially when young. And I've certainly bought stuff from garden centers that I thought was one thing and ended up being another. So you may have to wait and see for that one. The other thing that sometimes Donald kind of mentioned too, that maybe if you're doing a lot of fertilizing, you may be promoting a lot of foliar growth and not seeing the development of that kind of bulbous stem. So I don't know if you're doing a lot of fertilizing or not, but that may be a role in it too.
Well, I'm not doing a lot of fertilizing, okay. And I planted from seed, a seed packet.
Oh, okay, good.
And they just look great. And the 16-foot row doesn't have one single bulb in it. It's growing right next to some kale that's looking good.
Yeah.
And the Brussels sprouts are looking great. And
It's
kohlrabi.
Yeah, and it may just be something we'll have to wait. You know, a lot of things have been late. I mean, everything this year seems to be at least a week later than it maybe typically would be. You know, peonies seem to be a little bit later this year. And so it may just take this plant a little bit longer to get moving than it normally does this year. Apart from waiting and seeing, I'm not sure I can give much more advice.
All right. Well, good luck, Jim. Let's fit a couple of email questions in here. This one's from Dave. I have a 3-year-old productive strawberry patch. I started picking them in late May. They're now at the end of the season. I recently read that I should run a lawnmower over the plants at the end of the season. Is this a recommended practice? And when should I do it, if I should?
Yeah, if you have the June-bearing types, now you could do that and kind of encourage new runners to form so that next year you have a nice new crop of plants to get fruit from.
All right. And is white clover best eradicated from a lawn by using a pre-emergent in the spring or a herbicide in the fall from Earl?
You'll want to use a broadleaf herbicide if you want to go that route. You know, of course, white clover isn't a bad thing in your lawn necessarily. It's a great support for pollinators. And the original lawns from the Victorian era were half white clover. So,
all right. So maybe you're just very Victorian.
Yeah, exactly.
We are at my house. All right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. Aaron Stile, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens and Ames. Donald Lewis, Iowa State University Professor of Entomology. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. With me, Donald Lewis, Iowa State University Professor of Entomology, and Aaron Stile, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens in Ames. They are here to answer your questions about plants and insects. And you can call us, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Linda is on the line next in Iowa City. Hi, Linda.
Good morning.
Hi.
I have a concolor fir that was actually looking gorgeous this spring as it leafed, as those needles and the new growth came out. But now I'm seeing a lot of kind of like curling up of the finer interior needles on the branches. And then I'm also seeing on a more mature concolor something that kind of looks like bagworms with the needles and that sort of thing that develop on the pines, but it isn't. They just kind of drop and hang down there, and it's very loose cluster of needles. Just kind of wonder what's going on.
Well, I think the interior needles falling off, the simplest explanation for that may be annual needle drop. Certainly the needles that are on any of the evergreens don't last forever. And so the older ones are going to eventually drop off. Now, usually we would see that maybe at a slightly different time of the year, but, wet conditions and heavy soils, both of which Iowa's had this year, heavy soils all the time, but, are not good spots for most needled evergreens. And so wet conditions would put a lot more stress on these plants than maybe other plants, which could cause some needle drop because of that. So making sure that these things are, that this fir is in well-drained condition as it can be, would be important. It's not easy to change, of course, at this point, but that may be one of the reasons why we're seeing the needle drop is just wet conditions or just simple annual needle drop. The clusters of needles, I'm not sure about this one.
No, I'm not either. It is the time of the year we would expect to see bagworms, and you're far enough south that the bagworms are probably going to make an appearance sooner or later. But they don't dangle from the plant. They hang on with their legs and move from along and feed on the foliage. So something else has caused clusters of needles, and I don't have a good answer for that one either.
Yeah, I just think it looks very interesting because this is on a very mature tree, and just on the north side are these little things, and I'm like, no, those aren't the bagworms. They're just little hanging clusters of leaves off the ends, or needles. So.
Well, you've got us interested, too.
Maybe we just chalk it up to Iowa.
Yeah, it's just, or we blame the weather for everything. But you've got me interested in what these hanging clusters of needles would be. So if you could send me a couple of digital pictures, I'd be glad to take a look and see if we can figure it out. And if I can't, we've got other specialists. We'll pass it around on campus. But If you can take good pictures and send them to insects, plural, insects, at iastate.edu, insects at iastate.edu. I'll take a look at the pictures and see if we can give you a better answer than we can over the radio.
All right, Linda, thanks a lot for your call. 866-780-9100. Let's go to Robin next in Des Moines. Hi, Robin.
Hi.
What's your question?
I have a knockout rose, my first time growing them, and they have little white dots that have recently appeared on the leaves. And as I look under the leaf, I see a tiny, almost translucent caterpillar.
Sure. Rose slug is what we call that, and a better name is the rose sawfly. It should look light green to translucent. It should be almost slimy looking, a little bit carrot shaped, bigger at the head than it is at the tail. And what they do is they live on the undersides of the roses, and they scrape off the leaf material from the underside, but they leave the veins and they leave the top epidermal layer, epidermis. So, yeah, it's disfiguring. Those spots will turn whitish or brown eventually. If it's already half an inch, we're near the end of its development. So live and let live will probably be your best choice. I've seen some climbing roses that looked pretty ugly after a rose slug infestation. But, you know, the rose is going to live. It'll be back. It'll be fine. It's just a little disfiguring. And it would take a lot of spray earlier in the season, and you would have to spray the undersides of the leaves to control them. So I think this is like black spot and Japanese beetle. You can live with it if you can, and if you can't, you'll have to take some pretty intensive measures to correct it.
All right, and will they be back next year?
Oh, you know, I see them. There's a climbing rose that I tend to watch because I go there frequently, and I see them more years than not, but I don't see them every year. So
okay.
I think
so just because you have them 1 year doesn't mean that you'll have them the next year.
No, it's quite variable, and I think it varies from place to place and from year to year, and these things tend to come and go.
All right. Robin, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, Kathy in Des Moines. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, I've got a question about Korean lilacs. What I did was transplant some bushes from a very shady area to a very sunny area. Mm-hmm. And of course, the leaves burned. They're not completely gone, but they're not pretty. I just didn't know if I should go ahead and trim the bush back to help promote new growth at the bottom. Or if I should just leave it alone. I think otherwise I've scratched the stems. You know, they're all green. It's not dying.
Yeah. Yeah, I would at this point leave it alone. There was a lot of stress in the transplanting, and then those leaves weren't ready for that much sun. There's a very likely chance that some of those branches will re-break, and you'll get some new leaves to replace it, especially since it happened this early in the season. That will put a lot of stress on the plant, so you'll want to treat it as nicely as possible that you can this year, watering when it needs water, but being careful not to overwater accidentally, and doing that all the way through the growing season, all the way up through until the ground freezes. Sometimes we kind of, the end of September comes and we kind of let this stuff on its own, and that's a time period, especially for newly transplanted things or things that are under a lot of stress. Going into the winter dry is really detrimental. So just taking good care of it until then, it should pull through just fine.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for your call, Kathy. 866-780-9100 is the number. Next up, let's go to Sharon in Waterloo. Hi, Sharon.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I have a rose question. I live in my former grandmother's home, and I know the rose that was there, she brought from the farm at least 70 years ago. Mm. I have been living on the property since 2005. I've not done anything to it. She died in 86. So between 86 and 2005, nothing happened to it. The house was empty. I haven't done anything to it. Rumor has it that she used to put her coffee grounds on it to help fertilize it. But this year, it has done well every year. This year, I got like I think it's sort of a climbing rose. It has about 6 to 7 foot tendrils that come out.
Mm-hmm.
This year I got maybe 4 or 5 tendrils that turned green and flowered nicely. The rest of them are just brittle and dry. Should I cut them back? I've never done, like I said, I've not done, ever done anything to them. We did try to transplant one of them a couple of years ago, and that did not work. They didn't like the new location.
Hmm.
But I really want to save the plant.
Yeah, it may have been hit kind of hard by the winter, depending on what it was. And you may be seeing some of that dieback from those cold temperatures over the winter. If it is brown and brittle, you can cut it off, and you can do that anytime now. And then I think just doing a good job of treating it well. Those stems that are there sound like they're healthy. It sounds like this plant just got knocked back, likely by the weather in some way. There was a perfect storm of conditions that caused this plant to not be happy. It pulled through, and so you'll want to treat it as well as you can. If it gets dry later in the season, you want to water it, just kind of keep an eye on it. But if at this point if stems are dead, you can absolutely remove them. It'll at least improve the appearance.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for your call, Sharon. Next up, Carolyn in Story City. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi.
Hi. What's your question?
I have been noticing, of course, that the milkweeds are starting to be eaten, and I'm looking for the caterpillars just for fun. Well, I found the tiniest black and yellow, baby caterpillar. Looks mm-hmm. like a newborn.
Sure.
I would like to know more about that.
So how tiny the monarch caterpillars might be when you first find them? Is that what you're asking about, Carolyn?
That what happens to it next? I went back to try and find it again just for another look. Could not find it. There are predator bugs, I would imagine.
Predators
I would like to know how quickly they grow. I'd love to keep it.
Okay.
Look on this growth and what they do.
Well, thanks, Carolyn.
The black and yellow does describe the monarch caterpillar. They're sort of black, yellow, and white with stripes that go across the body. And when the female monarch lays her eggs on the underside of the milkweed leaf, the egg is visible to the naked eye, but the size of a big pinhead. And the caterpillar that emerges from the egg can be no larger than what you could put inside a pinhead. So it's really very tiny when it comes out. And if they're successful and if they eat and grow, they can eat for a month. And during that time, they will grow from about 1/4 inch up to 2.5 inches in length. So there's a huge amount of growth that comes from eating a huge amount of milkweed leaves. But your experience of finding it one day and not finding the next is one of the realities of life, that milkweed caterpillars have lots of challenges. They can fall off and not find their way back. They can get an upset stomach and fall off and die. There are ants and wasps that are looking for caterpillars as a food source. So the wasps may have come and found that caterpillar and eaten it and taken it away. And there's just a whole lot of challenges, problems to grow a caterpillar up to the full grown size so that it can transform to the butterfly. We're always pleased and pleasantly surprised when it works, and we're sad when it doesn't, but loss of caterpillars is a reality of the world.
And Donald, I know a lot of people who, when they find those monarch caterpillars, now are taking them in and feeding them and helping them through that transition. How do you feel about that?
Well, I used to feel like that was a good thing. I've raised caterpillars inside. I've given them to my mother and said, here, you have to give this a caterpillar leaf, or a milkweed leaf every day. When I came back a week later, she was just ecstatic, telling me, I don't know what happened. It changed into this chrysalis in the cage. Well, it's supposed to, Mom. So I appreciate that. But now in the last week, we get this article that says raising them inside, raising them in the lab, having artificial conditions around them when they're growing, ruins their ability to go to Mexico in September. Oh, no. So here we thought we were helping the monarchs by raising them inside. So we may be releasing monarchs out into the world as a butterfly, that just wander around randomly until they freeze to death and never do make it to Mexico to contribute to the overwintering population. So that was a study that just came out a week ago, and I'm still digesting that, trying to figure out, gee, you know, there's such a great educational value in raising monarchs that are we going to pass up that educational value to try to leave the monarchs outside where they face other challenges and still may not make it? I haven't decided yet.
Okay. Well, we'll check back in.
All right.
That's a hard one.
Give me some time.
All right. Steve's on the line next in Baxter. Hi, Steve.
Hello. How are you? And thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's your question?
Well, I have a black raspberry patch that I've had for several years, and I've kind of redoed it a couple times. But over about 3 years ago, I started getting this vining invasive weed that comes up there in the thing, and it just comes up and wraps around all the different vines. And I usually try to pull them out, but after the harvest is done, I leave them alone because it's too thick and too many cuts on my skin. So anyway, last winter, these vines come up, and there were so many of them that they all laid on top of the raspberry bushes with their flowering substance or whatever they were doing. And when the snow came last winter, real heavy, it collapsed the whole thing and pushed them all to the ground. The rabbits moved in and cleaned out the whole raspberry patch.
Wow.
I thought that was giving me the opportunity to clean it up and make sure those weeds didn't come back. They're back with a vengeance. Mm-hmm. And every you pull them, they just pull out of the ground like not like asparagus, but they break off deep. But there's a root system that's gotten large. I dug down and find out they're coming off of a root that's almost as big as my finger, mm-hmm. A little finger that runs all throughout the yard. And now this moved into my regular garden. I went out yesterday and started pulling. I pulled over 90 of these things out, but they just come right back.
Yeah, they are tenacious.
Okay, so yes. What do you do?
So it sounds like you have, there's a couple different names I've seen for this, vining milkweed, honey vine. This is a perennial weed, which is part of what makes it so difficult to control. And when you let it get bigger, it sets an incredible amount of viable seed as well. And so the key to controlling this, I have this in my yard too. I have the exact same experience with pulling it that you have. It is very difficult to control that way, but you can get it controlled that way if you are persistent and you do not let these plants get to flowering or get to seed so that it spreads even more. So you have kind of there's no silver bullet to get rid of this one, unfortunately. You can use a non-selective herbicide as well that may help get the root, but a lot of times it's really difficult to apply a herbicide like that because they're crawling and rambling over things that you don't want to hurt. So finding the base of it, removing it, do not let it go to seed, being very persistent is about the best way to tackle this one.
So stay at it for how long?
It's going to take a couple years.
Okay. Yeah. Good. Enjoy that, Steve.
I wish if I came up with a silver bullet for this, I could retire to a tropical island, I think.
All right. Well, we are out of time, but Aaron Style, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens and Ames, Aaron Style, and Donald Lewis, thank you.
Thank you, Charity. It's always a pleasure.
Donald Lewis, Professor of Entomology at Iowa State University. We will be back again, not next Friday with Hort Day. We're going to take the 5th of July off, but we'll be back the week after that. Don't worry, we'll have something on the air. It just won't be Hort Day. Talk of Iowa is produced by Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Have a great weekend.
It's 10:15.